Guys, it's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. And you know what? It's officially the holidays, that magical month between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So, to get in the spirit, first up, we've got self-proclaimed not writer, Tyler Cord, who happens to be one of the best writers I know. Tyler owns Number 7 Sub in New York City, also wrote a super upsetting book about sandwiches. That's the name of the book, a super upsetting book about sandwiches. We sent Tyler up to Montreal, which is perhaps the best wintry eating city in all of North America. And we talked to him about his adventures in foie gras and smoked beef and everything in between. And after that, senior food editor Claire Saffitz comes on to talk edible gifts that you make yourself, you know, getting all Martha Stewart, and you've got your little ball jars and packages and tags and ribbons out. We got a recipe for a homemade caramel sauce that is spectacular. And kind of a, I guess you could say, kind of a healthy-ish pancake mix with like rye flour and buckwheat flour. All right, but first, here's Tyler and me. Tyler Cord, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, thanks.
Since we last saw you here, you not only had a baby, but you also went to Montreal.
I did both of those things.
The same week.
Yeah, in the same week. It was intense.
So that's got to be the first question. We wanted to assign a piece for our Christmas issue on like Montreal because it's such a beautiful wintry wonderland and it's right there across the border and it feels like you're in another country, which apparently you are.
Yeah. And
turns out. So you agreed to do the article for us, but you didn't tell us it was the same week that you were reporting the piece was the same week that your wife was due.
Well, you don't say no to a free trip to Montreal no matter when your child is due to be born, right?
I guess
I did say something to Andrew Knowlton about it, and I was like, there is a chance I'm going to have to like get on a plane in the middle of this and kind of like rush back to New York for a baby. And he was like, we'll figure it out. You can go back another time.
All right, Montreal. Not only that was one thing I didn't know that you were due with the baby, but also that your father was from Montreal.
He lived there for a while when he was a little kid. Yeah, uh-huh. That was the kind of. It was a part of the immigration route to getting eventually here. But yeah, he and his family in the 30s, my dad's old and his dad was old. Like my grandfather was in World War I. He would be like 120 years old. I was just doing the math with my aunt and uncle.
If he were living in Japan and eating fish every day,
totally.
he'd be 120 today.
Yeah.
So they came from where? They immigrated from where?
Satu Mare, and it's Romania now. It was Hungary when they left. It goes back. It's one of these places that's gone back and forth between a couple different borders, but it's technically Romania, but he speaks Hungarian.
Okay, so Hungarian Jews who migrated to Montreal. What did you had you ever been there with him? Did you know much about the city?
No, I didn't know much about it at all. He's told me stories about it, and he was very insistent that I read some Mordecai Rischler before I went. I was actually reading one of his books while I was there, which was interesting because it felt like I was reading about my dad. It was interesting. It was neat.
Now, did you take your dad to Montreal?
No.
No.
We talked about it, but I didn't think he was going to be up for the 6 meals a day that I had to eat every day, and it was a lot of walking. And anyway, so no, but I would love to go back. I want to go back, and I'd love to take my folks and my wife and my kid. And
yeah. All right. So you're
my daughter is wearing her Montreal onesie that I got her at the airport on the way back.
Oh, nice.
Today, so.
So you went to Montreal. You did bring a wingman because it's tough to do all that eating. So you brought Francis Lamb, who edited your book, a super upsetting book about sandwiches. So, all right. So it's interesting because Montreal as a city has gotten a ton of food press over the last decade or so primarily for two restaurants, Joe Beef and Opie du Cochon.
Sure.
Sort of foie gras central.
Yeah.
Poutine and all that stuff. There's also a long history of great Jewish, I don't know, you call it deli food there, or?
I mean, the deli food probably gets the most press, but I think there's lots of different, there's a full spectrum of like Eastern European, Romanian, Jewish cuisine there.
Yeah, and then there's also a lot of current new restaurants. So let's start with the smoked beef and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was that like, and how did it compare to the deli food you have here in New York City?
I had a whole big list of restaurants, and most of the restaurants were new, and I had a lot of food that I needed to eat while I was there, but I really did still want to go do the touristy old Jewish things. Eating a smoked meat sandwich was just kind of like, yeah, let's take care of that. Let's knock that off the list. And Schwartz's was like kind of on the way to a lot of different places that we were going to. So we went there, sat down, but it was just a quick, like, let's split a sandwich. Let's get out of here. And
it's
let's
like
eat.
Grabbing a hot dog totally. On the corner on
not,
the way to somewhere.
It was not something we were going to spend a lot of time or energy on. And we went in and it was like going to Katz's. Everybody was kind of like, they kind of made fun of us a lot and, but like with a happier wink in their eye at all times. Like everybody was like, it was gruff and like also so charming and delightful. Yeah. And we sat and we split a sandwich, which the guy thought was hilarious. And in the end, it was like it was delicious. It wasn't, I was expecting, all right, we're just going to go to sit down in this place and eat a pastrami sandwich and then move on. But it didn't taste like pastrami. It was smoky, but it wasn't, I don't know. In New York, I feel like all pastrami, I feel like somebody's going to be really mad at me for saying this, but it kind of, all the pastrami tastes the same to some degree. You know, it's like the same spices, the same cooking technique. There's a little variation, but like if you get a pastrami sandwich at Katz's and you get one at the Second Avenue Deli, it's not, it's not that different. Schwartz's tasted like something else. Like it didn't taste like pastrami to me. And it was.
Was it good?
It was amazing. It was so, so good. It was like a gentler, more subtle kind of thing. I admittedly, I'm more of a corned beef than a pastrami guy in general. And it was somewhere, it almost tasted like somewhere in between. But then you'd get these like pops of coriander and pops of, it was, go there. It's wonderful.
And it was on rye with a little deli mustard?
Correct. And I wanted to eat it. I thought about it the whole trip. I kept wanting to go back. I could only have so many meals.
You did have one sandwich twice, you wrote about.
I did, it was a corned beef sandwich, and I did have it twice.
And where was that?
That was at Hof Kelsen, which is a newer kind of bakery cafe. And the baked goods, the bread and the pastries are unbelievable there. It's this guy, Jeffrey
Finkelstein.
Who is an accomplished dude. He's like worked in a bunch of kitchens in Europe, and I think he went to the Culinary Institute, maybe. I don't know. He's an interesting, smart, talented dude, and he makes this sandwich that's this awesome seeded rye bread and puts corned beef on it and some cabbage, and there was Russian dressing. Mm. You can read about it in the thing. But it was so good that I was like embarrassed about this, but I did eat it because I was there. I had it the first day that I was there. Francis didn't get there till the second day. So when Francis got there, I was like, oh, you have to come check out this bakery. I was just going to get him to eat the sandwich. And I was just going to watch him eat the sandwich. And I wasn't going to eat the sandwich again because we can talk about this, but there was just so much food that I had to eat while I was there. So as a reporter,
you were just going to observe him eating. Yeah. But then you ended up going in for half again?
And then I had to eat it. It was so good. It was one of the best sandwiches I think I've ever had.
As a sandwich maker yourself, when you taste a sandwich like that, do you get inspired or do you get jealous?
I don't know. I think my feelings were just that of admiration because I wasn't so much inspired because we've done things like that. But at this point, we make such a huge volume of sandwiches that it turns out to like brine things for 5 days. There's no space for all that. So it wasn't necessarily inspiration like, oh, I should go back to pickling beef again, because that's just kind of crazy for us anyway, with multiple shops. As far as like jealousy goes, I don't know. It was an awesome sandwich. Like I was just so happy to get to eat it.
All right. So when reporting a story like this, a big part of it for a food writer is the logistics. Because you have to hit X number of meals a day. You're there for X number of days. You have one stomach. How did you?
Yeah, next time I would rather do like next time if I get to do this again. And everyone, please write in and tell them to let me do this again because I did such a good job.
He did.
But I want to spend like 2 weeks there. It was like 5 days, and I had like 27 restaurants to go to, and it was intense.
So what did you do? Did you walk a lot, or what was the plan?
I did. I walked everywhere, even though it was stupid cold there. But it was nice to walk around and to work off some of that food. Because there wasn't a whole lot else to do because it was so cold. But at the end of the day, it was just an incredible amount of eating. And I, every time Francis and I would get to a restaurant, I'd be like, all right, but seriously, we've had three lunches. This is the first of two or three dinners. let's just order like a couple things. We'll taste them, but then we'll move on. Like, we don't need to go big here. And then inevitably the server would come over and Francis would order like the whole menu.
So you're blaming Francis.
I am. And he'd be like, no, we'll just taste, like, we don't have to eat everything, but we're also the kind of people that we both like would clean all of our plates. It was disgusting.
So you mentioned, all right, so Damas. Yeah. You mentioned going, and it's a sort of modern new Syrian restaurant. And you have this one line here. First of all, I feel like I should read a lot of this piece to the listener, because there's some very funny lines in it. But you said, and for the record, I ate at Damas directly after the foie-pocalypse at Opied de Cochon. And while I was planning on having just one bite here and a bite there, I ended up eating a full-on second dinner and felt surprisingly great afterwards. Maybe it was the shots. So you talk about doing shots with the waiter. I mean, anyone who goes to Opied de Cochon, they're usually done. Like, that's it.
Yeah,
they're down for the count.
It's aggressive.
So talk about that night. So what did you have at Opied?
They have a whole section of the menu that's just foie gras, and that's not totally my thing. I wasn't like, oh, we have to go to Opied de Cochon, we have to eat all the foie gras, but it turns out, I don't know, that's just what you eat when you're there, I guess. Because even like, there's a section on the menu of foie gras dishes, but there's still foie gras in like 70% of the rest of the menu. They just have other stars. I don't know.
What was the best thing you ate at Opied?
It was like the pike quenelle dish, but it wasn't pike, it was like a scallop quenelle in a muscly broth with some kind of this like dry sausage that they make there. That we had some of that sausage just on a plate at one point, and then that sausage found its way into a few dishes. Anyway, it was like one of the few not foie gras dishes, and it was super delicious. We didn't get the like whole pig's head, and we didn't get the like apparently there's like a can full of foie gras that they will dump out onto a bowl in front of you. There's some gratuitous stuff there. We didn't go like that big, but I think we did the math. We'd each had like half a pound of foie gras by the end of that meal, and I feel horrible about that because I don't fully support the consumption of foie gras. I felt really weird about it, but you know, whatever, we did what we had to do.
you took one for the team.
Yeah. But then we went to this other restaurant, and then it was like, all right, well, let's just taste an appetizer. And then Francis
but
ordered.
I don't understand how, though. You must have been dying after.
I know, yeah. I didn't feel great, but then...
And then you walked to Damas, I assume? Yes.
That one we actually took a cab to because we were running out of time and it was kind of far away. Because some of these places were strict about reservations. And it was like the restaurants were all packed despite it being the middle of a really intense winter. And we sat down and we watched our server drink shots with the table next to us. And we were like, we want to drink shots with the server. Not Francis, because he doesn't drink. But,
I was about to say, yeah.
But we had met this other buddy of ours. The server came over and we drank. It was this like cinnamony, lemony, something, most delicious shot I've ever had kind of shot. And then I was ready to eat dinner again. And it was so delicious. That Damas was so good.
Yeah. So we have this section in the magazine where you say, where I'll take my wife. You kind of divided up the article between where I'll take my parents, where I'll take my wife. And then was there another one? I thought that. Oh, yeah. The first place I'll take my newborn. There's a funny line. Okay, so it's cold, very cold there. You're walking around. And you're talking about Nora Gray, this restaurant. And you write, walking out of the cold into a restaurant in Montreal is like getting into a hot tub with a Brandy Alexander in hand next to a stereo playing Van Halen on a clear winter night. Parentheses, I'm not saying I've ever done that, but doesn't that sound amazing? Have you really never done that?
I don't think so, but I would love to do that. I forgot I wrote that, and now just listening to that line, I'm like, yeah, that is awesome. I rule at writing.
What was Nora Gray like?
Nora Gray was amazing. That was also a second of two dinners. Like, I had to tap out at one point. We were, like, probably two-thirds of the way through that meal, and I just was like, I can't do this anymore. I still had a bite of dessert, but it was a lot of food. But Nora Gray was awesome. I'm not a fresh pasta guy. In general, I just would rather, like, I think that's neat and all, but, like, just make me the dry pasta because it tastes better.
I'm of two minds of that. There's this notion that fresh pasta is inherently better, I think is false. Like,
yeah.
And it obviously depends on the dish. If you're making linguine vongole, I don't need fresh pasta with my clams.
Right.
But sometimes, like, the fresh pasta and silky little transparent, you know, raviolis or whatever.
Sure.
Especially the filled ones are amazing. You know?
Absolutely. That said, I had... basically spaghetti vongole with fresh pasta, and it was like,
oh wow, you did
the greatest pasta I've ever. It was so, the pasta was so good.
Speaking of tapping out, see, this is, I did a piece a couple of years ago in Philadelphia with Emil Stonick, one of our editors, where we did a whole walking tour for 2 days of, again, tried to hit like 23 restaurants over the course of 2 days. And throughout the day, we were walking from place to place, also on a cold day. By the end of the day, I felt good. I was like, you know what? We just went to 12 different restaurants, but we kept moving. We're getting exercise. It's brisk out. Went back to the hotel, took a little like lie down, bath, that sort of stuff. You know, like a bath in a hotel, light some candles, just chill out, watch Sports Center. And then we made the mistake of going to Zahav, Michael Solomonov's restaurant that evening. No, actually we went to a fancy place first for hors d'oeuvres at the bar. And then we went to Zahav.
Yeah.
And that is like when all of a sudden I started to get like the meat sweats. And he sent out some crazy glazed lamb shoulder, and you're just like, what did he say? Couldn't leave well enough alone or whatever. It's like you were at a good place, but then you had, I felt like I pushed it too much.
Yeah.
And then the next day I woke up feeling like hell and still had another day of eating to do.
And that's the kind of pushing, and the next day you're like, what am I, what is life about?
Having someone like Francis Aaron. So Francis is an editor. He's a writer, won a ton of James Beard Awards, et cetera, et cetera. Having a fellow food writer with you, does that help you sort of put things into perspective as a, or sort of into context as a writer? Or is it like, oh gosh, Francis is here. That's a lot of pressure.
Well, I appreciate you calling me his fellow food writer, because that's...
Well, you did write the story.
I wrote about food. But I don't, you know, I don't feel like a food writer per se. No, it was great having him there. We talked a lot about, he gave me a lot of advice, and we talked a lot about like, he gave me a lot of advice about how, about kind of writing about the, and I probably did a horrible job of actually taking said advice, but about kind of writing about how the city felt about, you know, atmosphere, maybe more, not more than the specific dishes, but, you know, just trying to give people a feel for things. And he's really good at that, and I, you know, I gave it a shot. Yeah. The only thing that sucked is he just made me eat more than I'm capable of.
It's kind of like going, it's kind of like, you know, just like cruising around with Yoda, and he just sort of gives you advice.
Sure.
All right, so you start the piece on a dark and windy night last December in the middle of a brutally cold snowstorm in Montreal, where everybody was speaking French and acting like it was no big deal. I ate one of the greatest bowls of soup I have had in years. And then at the end of the piece, you get to this bowl of soup at Agricole.
Yeah. It was a tricky thing. It was the last night. Francis left. He got there the second day. He left the day before I did. But in the meantime, my best buddy in the world, Matt, came up. He's the guy that designs and builds all the restaurants in New York.
And all of the restaurants?
Pretty much all of them. Name a restaurant. He probably designed it and they built it. So he came up the last couple nights. So he was the one. He was with us at Damas, but he. My last night in Montreal, he and I were walking around, and we agreed. I had two lunches that day, but then I had two dinner reservations. But Francis was gone, and I feel like I was like, okay, let's take it easy. I don't have to order every single thing in Montreal. And so Matt and I were walking around, and I canceled the second dinner reservation, but I kept the one at Agricole. Because that sounded interesting and fun. So, but again, I wasn't even remotely hungry. We walked for like an hour and a half, and I still wasn't hungry. But we got there and had a drink. And
well, explain the restaurant. So, what type of restaurant? Who owns it? That sort of stuff.
So it's a Haitian restaurant, and I believe the chef owner is Haitian. It sounds like it's a partnership involving some of the guys from Arcade Fire. I want to say
that's what So I've read.
It's, you know, it's pretty cool, but. At the end of the day, it is, it seems a pretty legit and awesome Haitian restaurant, but it is cool. It is definitely like cool. Like the people in there were cool, and the space is really neat. It's this like weird little house with like a second floor kind of balcony thing where people are sitting. And it is like, it's warm, and the music was great. And it was like a really intense snowstorm outside, and we walked into this place, and it was just like, this like warm Caribbean wonderful party going on in there, which just felt so incredibly right, you know, like a hot tub and a Van Halen and a Brandy Alexander. Anyway, so we sat down, I had a drink, the bartenders were great. The service across the board in Montreal was wonderful. Everybody was just like so after the initial hiccup, everywhere we went, they would always try to speak French to me, and then I would explain that I didn't understand it, and then they were super sweet, and we spoke in English. And anyway, so they told us about the specials, and there were some fried plantains, and there were some this and some that, and a bowl of soup for two people. And after a week of eating all of the food in Montreal, that was the last thing that I would even have considered eating. But Matt, of course, was like, "We will have the soup for two." And I was like, "Dude, come on." And out comes this enormous bowl of soup. And it was so delicious and so perfect. And
so
like,
what was it?
It was a pureed squash soup, but it was like a...
You want me to read it? I'm going to read it. I'm going to read you being you. One of the specials was, quote, a celebratory Haitian soup for two, end quote. And even though a giant bowl of soup was figuratively the last thing I wanted to see, of course, my friend insisted we try it. Parentheses, see what I did there? We're back at the soup, because this is like a little writer's trope where you come back
to
the
lead. It's like a movie.
Out came a giant steaming bowl of soup. Jumu. A puree of squash cooked in beef stock with chunks of potatoes and parsnips, small meat-filled dumplings that look like ravioli, and a giant marrow bone sticking out like a lighthouse in a blizzard of coriander seeds and cilantro leaves.
I'm super good at writing, right?
You are good at writing. You should keep it up.
Just kidding.
It was served with two of my favorite things in the known universe, a lime for squeezing and grilled crusty bread for dipping in the broth. Oh, I love grilled crusty bread.
I do too. And I just always want a lime to squeeze on everything. Like, that should just come with every dish.
Is there anything worse when you go to the store or you're at like some random bar and they give you the dried out lime wedge and you're trying to squeeze it in your drink and like nothing comes out?
That is a bummer.
You're just like, really?
It's nobody's fault. But yes, that's a bummer.
That's just like,
The bigger bummer is that I do at number seven. I put a lime or a lemon wedge next to like most food there because I think it's so fun and nobody ever uses it. Then I throw them away. And
that's,
I'm like,
drag.
Don't you guys like to have
don't
fun?
You know?
Don't you just want to squeeze something on there?
Let's say you do this story again for us, but you pick a different city.
Yeah.
How will you do it differently, or how will you do it the same?
I would do my best to get Francis to go with me again, just because that's fun. You know, more time is obviously better, but also more time costs more. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's
so if you had a couple extra
it's
days,
tough
you could
fit
you could,
that
you,
much food in.
You could spread it out over a few
it's
more
like,
days.
It's like we've been joking about it. It really is tough to fit all that food in. And I've wanted to do a good job.
Yeah.
And I felt a lot of pressure to do a good job. So I really wanted to do my work and like eat all of the food. But it is so much food. Although, again, Montreal is such a specific place, too, where I had certain things that I did really want to try that didn't necessarily need to go into the article anyway. So I admittedly probably put more food into this trip than I needed to in some ways.
Coming clean. But also, man, let's be clear. Like, you went to what is probably the heaviest eating city in North America between the smoked beef and the foie gras and everything else. Like, this is not – it's not like you're doing lean Mediterranean cuisine.
That's true. They're not messing around.
I think the next city we dispatch you to can be...
Should be like in Minnesota.
No.
We should go heavier.
No, we're going someplace super super lean and clean. All right.
Let's talk about it. That sounds fun.
Tower Core, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for letting me write this piece. It was so fun.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Claire, let me just start off by saying I have never made an edible gift before. I don't even know if I've received an edible gift before, but I like the notion of an edible gift.
You never got like peppermint bark from Williams-Sonoma as a gift?
Well, I mean, not homemade
not
edible.
Homemade. Okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
And yeah, it's amazing, but that peppermint bark is quite good.
So are you going to do something this year?
I don't know if I will do something, but I will gladly receive something from you if you choose to make something for me.
Message received.
It's interesting because when people do the homemade thing, it is like, oh, that's actually thoughtful. It's so cliche, but it is the thought that counts.
Right. I think it's just good strategy because you don't always know how many holiday parties you're going to go to or be invited to, and when, you know, someone pops over, or you like, there's a lot of planning that you can't do around the holidays. And so it's actually, I think, easier and good strategy to just make like a big batch of some kind of edible gift. And then anytime you run out to a holiday party or you have like, you know, you're like, oh, I need a gift for this person, you just kind of grab something off your shelf and you're like, here's this beautiful thing I made for you.
So when you're making a batch of homemade so-and-sos, you're not necessarily doing it with this particular person in mind as much as like you've got your little elf factory going and you're going to make a number of them.
Right. I'm like, I need gifts for these five people, but I'm going to make five extra for the people I don't know who just show up or something.
I will say this. You always appreciate it when someone walks through the door with something in their hand. So when you are thinking about making an edible gift, first of all, when do you start baking or cooking, or what's your schedule?
Yeah, so I feel behind right now because I haven't started doing anything for the holidays. I have started as early as October. That was the year I made the fruit cakes, which we actually talked about on a previous podcast. That was like a months long project.
Okay, but that was insane. B, that's like they're supposed to sort of soak in the liquor. Anytime a cake has to age, you might want to think twice about eating that cake.
That cake impressed everyone that tried it, mostly because people's expectations were super low.
So we did a piece before. All right, I know we're going on a tangent here, but the piece was about how fruitcake is kind of always the butt of jokes, and it's not like something no one eats it. You get it, you give it to someone else, and you regift.
Right.
Why was this fruitcake particularly tasty?
Because it was real fruitcake, not like the stuff you buy. Well, I've never bought it, but like it comes in a tin that like really does weigh 12 pounds. I mean, these weighed quite a bit, but it's essentially just a lot of fruit bound together by like a molassesy cake that you soak in brandy like for weeks and like keep feeding it more brandy. And so, but then you cover it with jam and marzipan. Like, it's delicious. It's just a bunch of dried fruit. And you eat it with cheese. You can eat it like as a, like on your cheese plate. You can eat it for dessert. It was really tasty. And I had a recipe from a woman whose grandmother was like a Mrs. Patmore from Downton Abbey, like a cook in like a big house. And that was the recipe that family passed down. It was good. It was great.
All right. If there was a TV simulcast going on right now, you could see me looking skeptically at you.
Right. You're the emoji with the raised eyebrow.
Yeah, I'm like, with the little hand on the chin.
If I ever make them again, I'll save some for you.
Okay, so in this instance, you made, how many did you make?
Of the fruitcakes?
Yeah.
I made 3 9-inch fruitcakes. They were huge.
A lot of gift giving is the packaging.
Right.
So, like, what did you do with those, for instance?
Well, those I covered in a layer of jam, then marzipan, then royal icing, and then I painted them with luster dust. I really lost my mind on this project. But then I kind of cut them into smaller pieces and gifted them out because no one is going to – it would take you months to eat, like, a 9-inch
fruitcake. But how do you gift out smaller pieces of a fruitcake?
The presentation was a little lacking. I gave a whole one to someone, and that was – very beautiful, and that made, you know,
and you know what,
it weighed so much.
They still have it.
I actually got a text 3 months later that they had just eaten the last piece. But I think for edible gifts, that's not a great example because I do think packaging is one of the most important things because it matters how you present it, but also it needs to be transportable and not get like mushed in the process and kind of ruined. So I always think about that with edible gifts.
That's a good point. Form and function.
Yeah, they're equally important, actually.
All right, so let's talk about some specific ones for this holiday season. Mm-hmm. In the December issue of Bon Appetit, you have a recipe, we call it awesome sauce, also known as homemade caramel.
Yes. I think it's hard to beat this as an edible gift because it checks all the boxes. You can make a lot of it at once. You can package it individually. So in this case, we recommend you put it into like little 8-ounce jars, and it will keep for a very, very long time. So I could make this sauce, you know, the first week of December and give it out all throughout the holidays for Christmas.
Okay, well, let's talk about it. So this is a caramel sauce that you want to put on ice cream, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, serve it with apple pie. Ice cream is great. You can put it on crepes. You know, if you like are feeling fancy, you can put on your morning pancakes.
You might want to heat it up in the microwave first.
Definitely. So you have to heat it up. It solidifies when it's cold. So definitely keep it refrigerated, but it will stay in your fridge for, you know, a couple months.
Okay. So for instance, what will you, like when you say jars. What kind of jars do you like to use? And then do you decorate the jars somehow? Or
I really like, I mean, I have a lot of mason jars at home that have the sort of the removable like screw cap.
Yep.
Those work really well. The Weck jars, which I think is a German company, make for really beautiful packaging. They're a little simpler. They have like a glass top.
Okay.
Although now they come in, they have a wooden top, which is really pretty.
All right. I have some issues. All right. Well, first of all, the... Okay, so for the mason jars, what we all grew up with, the little screw-on
top. Yeah, the ball jars.
The ball jars, the two-piece tops. They have the flat part and then the screw. And then you'll use, like, are the small ones, like 6 ounces or so, or eight?
I think maybe? They come in four and then eight.
Eight, yeah. So you'll choose one of those. Like, it's probably the 8 ounce, maybe?
I think 8 ounce is nice. Yeah. It's a really manageable size, but it feels like, you know, a good, generous amount. And then I just put a bow on it, put a little piece of, like, red ribbon or something. And that's it. So I also have little stickers that you can put on top where you label it, which is
nice.
Ooh,
I like that. Yeah. Do you have good handwriting?
When you try. Yeah.
My issue with the Weck jars, and Weck jars became very, like, cool among the hipster Brooklyn artisanal set in the last 5 years or so. They've got, like, so it's the glass jar, and it's a little bit sort of slanted side. I don't know what a better word for, you know, they kind of tapers at the bottom a little bit. And they have the glass top, and they have those little sort of, like... Little metal clips. And I always find it very unpleasant when the metal grinds against the glass. And I'm like, there's got to be a better way to put a top on a jar.
Well, now they have these wooden tops that have more of like a rubber stopper kind of on the bottom. So you don't need clips. They kind of just seal on their own.
See, I like that. But
those are very pretty.
They also have, my wife has bought some for our house. We had a bunch of them and I found them all annoying. They also have the white plastic tops that go on.
Oh, but I haven't seen those.
But then that totally like defeats the purpose. Now you're like, oh, now it just looks like any old other piece of like sort of like Tupperware type of thing you got in your fridge, and it's not even cool anymore.
Right.
But it is functional. So that's right. I think ball jars are sort of unimpeachable on that front. Like they look good, they work.
Yeah. I reuse all of them. So I have a ton of them at home. I've used them for canning. I mean, they're designed for canning. But if like that piece on top wears out, like the rubber wears off, you can just buy replaceable lids, so they really last forever. And so I often have like a mix of any number of jars at home, so I like I'm constantly reusing them. And then when someone gives you one, or you finish a jar of jam that comes in one, save it, wash it, and keep it for the next time you have to give gifts.
They do last forever. All right, so let's talk about this caramel sauce, because you said you can make a big batch. Making a big batch of bubbling hot like scalding sugar syrup kind of scares me.
Yeah, sugar burns are bad.
Yeah.
So wait, tips to avoid.
So how are you doing this, and how are you doing big batch versions of
this? Well, this caramel is a wet caramel as opposed to a dry caramel. So that's
no idea what you're talking about.
Basically, it means when you melt the sugar, you're dissolving it in water first rather than just melting the sugar on its own in a pot. So that takes a little more technique, and it takes longer, and it's a little harder to get a more even product. You can easily scale that up because you're dissolving it in water first. I just recommend using a heavy-bottomed pot. So if I'm doing a big batch of caramel, I'll do it in my Dutch oven because that's a very heavy pot. So the problem with caramel is sometimes in a thin pot you get hot spots that can burn. So just to make sure you have even heat everywhere, use a Dutch oven.
Although I would say to that point, would you recommend a round Dutch oven as opposed to one of the oval Dutch ovens?
Yes. And a Dutch oven, preferably one that doesn't have, where it's enameled so you have a surface that's not dark, so you can see how dark the caramel is getting. Like a Le Creuset has like a sort of a cream-colored interior. Yeah. So that's better, so you can see how dark you're taking the caramel.
Whereas the Staub, that has like the black sort of like more like sort of cast irony interior. So you would not. Well, that's interesting. So you want to see it get brown.
Yeah, it's careful. It's important to be able to see how dark you're taking it. And I like to take caramel very dark. So with the caramel sauce, you're cooking it, but then you're stopping the cooking by adding cold butter and cream. So, well, in this case, I think it would be, say, room temperature.
Question.
Yeah.
When you add, quote unquote, room temperature or cold butter and cream, do you risk, like, the giant splattering and, like, volcanic sort of eruptions?
It does splatter a lot. So when you add the butter, I mean, you just have to use something with high sides and kind of keep your face tilted back. But, you know, if you add it one piece at a time, I wouldn't recommend dumping all the butter in. In the recipe, we break it down into every step. So it's saying, you know, add the butter a piece at a time, keep stirring. And that'll stop the cooking, but it won't, like, sputter like crazy. And so I like to take the caramel until I see, like, wisps of smoke rising from the surface. And you can smell also that it's become really, really kind of toasty. And, like, I think it makes a better caramel because you're tempering the sweetness with these sort of bitter caramel notes. You know, caramel's made of 100% sugar, basically. So just to make the flavor a little more complex, take it pretty dark.
What about salt?
There's a lot of salt. So this is a salted caramel sauce. I think we add a teaspoon of kosher salt per cup of sugar. You can use Malden. You can use fancy sea salt if you have it. Kosher salt is fine. Actually, kosher is a little bit better because it dissolves more easily.
Okay.
So we found that Morton's, which is a coarser salt, doesn't dissolve as quickly as something like Diamond, which is a little finer.
Morton's kosher as opposed to Morton's iodized.
Morton's kosher as opposed to Diamond kosher.
Yes. But no, but I'm saying when you said
Morton's.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, we don't, we, yeah. Yeah, no,
we don't
iodized,
even mess
sorry.
With that iodized.
I haven't touched iodized salt in probably 10 years.
I believe you. Okay, so, all right, so you got this delicious caramel sauce. You let it cool mm-hmm. a fair amount before you pour it into the jars, I imagine.
Yeah, you can stir it over an ice bath if you have to speed that up or just kind of leave it out on your counter and stir it occasionally. But at that point, it's extremely stable. So while it's still a little warm, pour it into the jars, seal them, and just stick them in the fridge, and they can stay there for, like, months and months.
Mm, I like that. Okay, you also have a recipe from our November 2015 issue on buckwheat, or actually December. Yeah, well, this is whatever. Anyways, because when it's in the December magazine, it
gets published
online in November, and it gets very confusing.
Right.
It's not easy being in publishing. Pancake mix.
Yeah, actually, this is a Chris Morocco recipe. But he developed this recipe sort of like a sort of whole grainy pancake. And I love the photo that we shot in the magazine that was just, you see, so it has rye flour and buckwheat flour, and you see all the layers of all the different dry ingredients packed into a jar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I think it's a really nice way to present the gift. And also during the holidays, like, people are hosting family, and they're having to plan not only dinners, but breakfast
also. Wait. Rewind this. So you would present it as a gift where you see these, like, layers, like a cross-section of, like, the earth sort of thing with, like...
Yeah, so the recipe's broken out into just the dry mix, and uh-huh. then you have assembly where you, like, add the eggs and buttermilk. So I've actually, last year I gave this recipe, I took all the dry ingredients and, like, layered them into a jar.
Again, like a ball jar, mason
jar? Yeah,
ball jar, yeah.
Something with a wider top. Uh-huh. Just so you can, it's, you know, you don't have to, like, use a funnel to get the ingredients in there. And then I kind of, like, shook the jar a little bit to level out each layer so that it made nice little, like...
So cool.
Yeah. And then I put a bow on it, and I gave it with, like, a fancy jar or a fancy bottle of, like, local maple syrup. To a pancake lover, actually my boyfriend's dad. I was like, I was struggling with gifts, and he was like, my dad loves pancakes, so this was the perfect gift. And then he would make them for himself.
And then you just do you give a little recipe card with it about
yes,
combined
exactly.
with four
yep.
eggs, yada yada.
I wrote like out sort of method, like, you know, whisk in a bowl with blah blah blah.
Yeah, blah blah blah. We use that all the time in Bon Appetit. Let me say a question, like. I love the notion these days of non-white flour pancakes. I like a little something that's a little crunchier or a little bit something more going on.
Yeah.
Could you add something else to this mix that gives you a little texture or crunch or something? Any little seeds or I have no idea. I don't know how to. I never made homemade pancakes before, really. I don't think. Maybe.
You never made homemade pancakes?
I guess I have, but never ones like this where you have, like, you know, all the little things going on.
Okay. Interesting.
I don't know. Do you do this sort of thing?
Well, I don't really like pancakes that much.
Oh.
And I'm actually a terrible pancake flipper. That's like my worst
what?
Kitchen skill. I'm really bad at flipping pancakes.
Because you were just going to splatter when you flip it over?
I don't know. I blame being left-handed. I don't know. I'm not good at it. And
lefty.
I don't really like pancakes. But so this recipe already has, you can't take out all the white flour with pancakes because they'll just become really, really like mm-hmm. dense. And kind of unpleasant. Like, I've had 100% buckwheat pancakes, and they're terrible, actually.
Yeah.
Like, they're dry. So this recipe has swaps in a third of the flour for either, like, whole wheat or rye flour, and then buckwheat flour. But I think you could add, I mean, Chris, again, did a recipe in Healthy-ish that had a whole bunch of, like, cooked whole grains in it. And that created such amazing, like, chewy texture in all of them. So if you have cooked wheat berries or rye berries or even like quinoa.
Yeah, yeah.
That adds
that's
like
pretty
really
cool.
fun texture.
So you can give this mix and you can say, hey, if you want to healthyize it even
yeah.
more.
Right. Or if you know the recipient, you can, and then you know what they like, you can kind of dress it up a little bit and add other mix-ins.
Yeah, I think if you can find that other, the recipe that Claire was, can we just call you Lefty from now on?
Sure.
That Lefty was referring to.
It's better than Half Sour.
Half Sour. That's your other nickname?
Brad nicknamed me.
Oh, God. But on our Healthiest website at BeHealthyish, BeHealthyish.com, if you just search for pancake recipes, those will show up. This one, this buckwheat rye pancake, and the other one that Chris developed, Well, Chris is like Mr. Pancake.
I know.
Who knew?
Yeah, really.
So anyways, yeah, I want healthier pancakes in my life, not because I want healthy pancakes in my life, but because I find white flour pancakes boring.
All right, well.
I eat one of them, and I'm like, okay, that was good. I don't need a whole stack of them. Listen, I think homemade pancakes where they get super crispy and crunchy on the outside and a little bit lacy, those are good. I find your average diner pancake where they're all just one color and they kind of tapered on the edges and there's no crispy. Like, those are just like diminishing returns.
Boring.
You take two bites and you're like, all right, I got it.
Do you know what I think the diner move is? I don't ever want to eat an entire plate of pancakes.
No.
Sometimes I want like a quarter of a pancake. So you just get like a little short stack to share.
Or I get the silver dollar pancakes, like the little, oftentimes the littler ones, you want more surface to interior ratio, you know, or whatever, edge, like, yeah, crispier. I just want the little guys.
Yeah.
And then waffles, I don't like the big divots on the waffles. I think that's BS. I like a basic sort of homemade. Emma's over here yelling at me in the production booth, like, this is not about edible gifts. You could make waffle mix. That would also be nice.
Sure.
Like a really good waffle mix.
But then it's like, do you have to give that with a waffle iron? I don't think a lot of people have waffle irons at home.
But they should have waffle irons. You know what are fun?
I don't have one. Do you have one?
You should get one because you don't have to flip them.
But what am I going to I live alone.
You know,
I'm make waffles for one?
You know what? I was in D.C. last weekend visiting friends, and they have one of those waffle irons that's kind of bulbous that you turn over halfway through when the light goes on, you know?
Uh-huh.
So it's like it rotates.
Like at a hotel breakfast bar?
Yeah, lobby pancakes, as when we had Mark Maron on the podcast. He calls them lobby waffles.
I think also it's like with pancakes and waffles, just you have to use buttermilk. I think that's
okay,
the way you get them to taste like anything.
Well,
but
exactly.
There's also like really beautiful artisanal buttermilk. It can also give that as a gift because that's something
that's nice.
A lot of people don't have.
Nope.
So give it with the mix. And you can include the recipe so that if they want to make it again for themselves, if they really liked it, then they can do that too. So gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, that's a good one. These are thoughtful gifts. Like this is better than just Star Wars Battlefront 2.
Right. Or the Bodega bottle of Chardonnay.
Yeah. Oh. God. No, actually, the bodega doesn't sell the Chardonnay. Bodega sells
the flowers.
Next to the liquor store.
Sell wine, but then it's really like,
yeah,
you can't show up with that.
No. But you know what you can show up with, Claire? You can show up with salted, seedy chocolate bark.
I don't remember when this was from, but last year we had a recipe that's a very similar idea. In French, they're called mendiant. They're like little chocolate coins that are decorated with different like dried fruits and nuts and seeds. So it's the same idea.
Which recipe do you want to do first?
Oh, well, it's basically the same.
All right. Well, all right. Let's talk freeform chocolate candies,
yeah,
which you can find on bonappetit.com from December 2016. So yeah, so they're like little sort of like silver dollar size coins, right?
Mm-hmm, right. And they're freeform, so you don't need molds. And also this recipe doesn't tell you to temper chocolate because I've never in my life successfully tempered chocolate.
How can you not? Why? What's so hard?
I don't know. It's like depends on like the temperature of the air and the humidity, and you have to have a candy thermometer. Like it's just not. It's I think for the home cook, it's more trouble than it's worth. And professional cooks use like machines that do it for them.
I just assume that you walk around with a candy thermometer in your jacket pocket.
I'm not there yet.
So talk to it. So this calls for 6 ounces semi-sweet or bittersweet chocolate. Melted slightly. Slightly melted, slightly cooled, and that is the those are all the recipes. That's all the ingredients.
Right. Well, so the toppings are like as you choose. You can use candied ginger, anything you want to eat with chocolate. I don't love chocolate and fruit together, so I'm not gonna like put candied orange peel. But if you love that combo, you can use that. But any kind of nuts or seeds.
I do like chocolate. I mean, I do like candied ginger.
Yeah,
that's nice.
And it's good with chocolate. You can also use any chocolate that you like eating out of hand, I would use for this recipe. So pick your favorite bar of chocolate and, you know, chop it up and melt it in the microwave or in a double boiler and start there. So you just as long as you like the taste of the chocolate, that's what I would use.
Okay, so question. So you're going to go out and buy one of those, you know, decent-sized bars of chocolate. What is your preferred candy like this? What is your preferred cacao percentage?
Cacao.
That's how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't like chocolate that's super dark, so I go between like 64 and 72, I think is nice. It's a good sweet spot. You could use milk chocolate if you want.
Get it, sweet spot.
Get it. Milk chocolate doesn't have as like firm a set.
Yeah.
So
you could do milk chocolate for the kids and then dark chocolate
for the
grown-ups.
Yeah, you could do a mix. You literally could mix the two kinds if one's a little sweet and one's a little dark. Or if you have just like odds and ends of chocolate bars at home, you can mix them together. And then you really just kind of doll up So this sort of slightly cooled melted chocolate onto like a parchment lined baking sheet.
Question. First of all, when you're melting the chocolate, do you do the double boiler thing where you put a bowl over boiling water, or can you just do it in a pan over low heat?
I recommend double boiler because chocolate burns really, really easily.
Okay. So you got a bowl of boiling water. You have a pot of boiling water, yeah. Set a metal bowl, chop up the chocolate, put it in there.
Simmer. The water should be kind of just barely bubbling. And then I use a glass bowl because I feel like I can see what's going on a little better. And then the water should not be touching the bottom of the bowl.
Okay.
That's the important thing. So the steam that's collecting in the pot is what's sort of gently like heating up the chocolate and melting it.
And don't just put the whole bar in there. Chop up the bar first, right?
Yes. I mean, you could. I mean, it would take a while. chop it up and then let it go and then take it off the heat and start occasionally and let it cool off a little bit. And then it's really, these are free form, so it's really, you can make any shape you want. We went with little coins. And I just use the back of a spoon to kind of, I dollop the chocolate onto parchment and then on a flat surface, that's important. And then just use the back of the spoon to kind of spread it out into a little, maybe 1.5 inch diameter circle. And then before the chocolate hardens, just put whatever toppings you like. So sesame seeds are nice. Candied ginger we talked about. If you want to be really fancy about it, you can use like little candied rose petals or other edible flowers.
Little sea salt, perhaps?
Salt is great, yeah.
You also have puffed quinoa or rice or puffed rice.
I don't even remember all the things that we said to put on top.
Roasted pumpkin seeds. I love those.
Yeah.
Pepitas.
Seeds are good, yep.
Bee pollen. I don't know if I'm going to be doing that.
It looks good, though.
Maybe, if you say so. Demerara sugar. That's like the cool sort of goldenish sugar.
Yeah, and if you're using dark chocolate, a little extra sweetness is nice.
Pecan halves.
Yeah, I love nuts and chocolate are great combos. You can do Marcona almonds are kind of fancy.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, and usually pretty salty.
Would you chop up those Marcona almonds? Because those are like the cool, like oily, salty ones.
Yeah, I think I'd leave them whole.
Leave them whole.
Yeah.
All right.
Which doesn't look better.
So, all right, let's say you've made these nice little chocolate coins decorated with a variety of interesting toppings. Then what do you do with them?
So because you haven't tempered the chocolate, you have to keep them chilled. Because they will easily melt again. So don't put them like on your heater while you're like turning around putting your shoes on or something if you're about to bring them to a party. Chill them, and then once they're hardened, you can peel off the parchment paper and then pack them into like little cellophane bags and put a little bow on top. I usually make one trip to the container store during the holidays because they have it's a really great place for all like the packaging stuff that you need. So they have all different size bags. You can buy different like colors of ribbon and string and like little tags, or you can.
I love the tags.
Yeah, I think you have to leave a tag because at a holiday party, like things get thrown on the couch or something, and you leave, and no one knows who brought them this beautiful bag of candies.
Happens all the time. You might have enjoyed a glass of Prosecco too much at your holiday party. You wake up the next morning, you're like, oh, look, all this cool stuff we got. And you're like, I have no idea who gave that to us.
Well, and if you're bringing the gift, you want credit for having made the homemade gift.
And then you know you have to go send an email to thank that person for bringing something, but you're not sure if they brought the chocolates or not. You're like, oh my God, thank you so much for your gift.
Right.
And you feel like such a loser.
Right. Just avoid all those awkward holiday moments.
All right. But with these chocolates, though, the melting factor, I'd be hesitant to just pile up a bunch of chocolates in a bag together because I worry that they would just get all mushed and melted together.
I mean, that's why you should keep them chilled. So if you bring them to someone's house, again, don't put them on the heater.
Stick
them in the fridge.
Just go into their fridge.
Yeah. But they'll be fine. And you know, you can hold them in the bag in your fridge and just kind of pull bags out as you need. You can also pack them into little boxes
kind of layers with a little layer of some sort of fancy paper in between. Mm-hmm. I like that. All right. Is there anything you haven't done as an edible gift that you aspire to, Claire? Maybe this year for a certain editor in chief. She's like, no.
No. Can I be honest?
Yeah.
I'm kind of out of ideas this year.
Really?
Yeah.
So our greatest hits then. What are you going to go back to? What's the one Claire Saffitz gift that always kills?
There are these little slice and bake cookies that I bring with me all everywhere, like all the holiday parties, and they're really, really good. But it's a recipe by Dori Greenspan, whom I have the privilege of interviewing this Friday.
Oh, nice.
I'm very excited and a little nervous.
Dori
so
is
I'm
like,
gonna talk to her about
she
that.
Is the cookie queen.
I'm like a weird fangirl.
Yeah.
So
you're not the only one.
I know.
And what? So which slice and bake cookies are these by her?
So they're called World Peace Cookies. They are. It's a very well-known recipe. You can find it on like a million blogs just by Googling. And they're really simple. It's like a sort of sable cookie, just cocoa, butter,
you know,
flour.
What? You know what? The average person, including me, doesn't know what the basic sable cookie means.
You know what a sable cookie is.
Let's say I don't know.
Okay. A sable cookie is basically a butter cookie that doesn't have, there's no baking soda or powder, so it's not like a, it's not puffy, it's not cakey, it has a very sandy texture. Sable just means sandy.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't get all, like, as it cook bakes, it doesn't puff up.
It doesn't puff, yeah. Right. Hers is a chocolate version, it has chopped chocolate in it, and you just roll the dough into logs. And it's another good tip is you can freeze the logs and then just pull them out of your freezer and
so you'll have, like, that's pretty cool. It's like your ammunition. In the, yeah. You have logs of frozen chocolate roll things in the freezer. You pull one out, defrost it, slice it.
You're only 10 minutes away from having cookies to either serve or bring somewhere. They're really, really good. I think it's the best cookie recipe we've ever made.
Wow.
They're so good. That's why I make them every year.
All right, guys. So you can Google that. World Peace Cookies by Dory Greenspan. Or you can go on to bonappetit.com for our buckwheat rye pancakes and our freeform chocolate candies and our caramel sauce in the December 2017 issue of Bon Appetit.
Yeah. If a senior food editor was going to give an editor-in-chief an edible gift, what would that editor-in-chief want?
I like the notion of the caramel sauce. I know my kid would enjoy putting that on ice cream.
Uh-huh.
I would probably enjoy putting on ice cream, too. Although, those cookies sound pretty good.
Okay.
You know,
noted.
It's the holidays. Why not have both?
All right. When in doubt.
All right. Thanks, Claire.
All right. Thanks.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.